to this week's version of the London Aesthetics Forum, which is kindly sponsored by the British Society of Aesthetics. Today our speaker is Richard Woodward, who is based at the University of Hamburg, and before that he was a researcher in Barcelona and a lecturer in Cambridge. And he works mainly on issues to do with, I think he said in his website, something like things that might not have existed and things that never will exist. So his interests kind of cross over into metaphysics about non-existent things, the philosophy of language for referring to non-existent things, and also, of course, into aesthetics and the nature of fiction and fictional characters. And today he's talking to us about a topic in aesthetics and philosophy of language on incomplete fictions.
Cool, thank you. Thanks very much.
Let me give some handouts.
Okay, so yeah, thanks for all being here. Thanks to Stacey for the invitation. The paper that I'm going to talk about is joint work with Robbie Williams, the philosopher, not the singer, from the University of Leeds. The paper has an interesting history. It began its life 8 years ago after a reading group that we had in Leeds when I used to work there. And Robbie thought that there was a certain problem for Kendall Walton's account of fiction based on incomplete fictions, and I never thought that the problem worked and didn't talk to Robbie about it again. About a year ago, I was working on some other things. I have some handouts. I was working on some things related to Walton that kind of reminded me of these conversations that we'd been having, and I wrote to Robbie and said, whatever happened to that paper? And he said, nothing. And 50 emails later, we have a talk. So yeah, it's an interesting case of sometimes you have to be very patient with ideas. They can take 8 years to germinate. Okay, so fictions typically leave many things open, okay? Lots of details in the story or film or whatever that you're watching or reading that are simply left untold. Okay. Now, sometimes what's left untold isn't left open in a certain sense. Okay. You know, you might not be told explicitly certain things about the characters, but based on background information that you're importing into the world, or maybe based on like a principle of aesthetic charity, or you know, something to do with the author's intentions, you can work out the thing that is true in the story, is fictionally the case, but it's just not told. But oftentimes, there are certain kind of propositions that look as though they're left open in a more radical way. It's not just that you're not told what the answer is. There's a certain sense in which you want to say that there's a kind of gap with respect to what's true in the story. Okay? So there might be a proposition that's neither true in the story nor false in the story. Okay, so classic kind of examples people give always involve Holmes's eye colour, which is actually a bad example because you are told what his eye colours are. You're not told what his shoe size is. Okay, you might be able to work out that there are certain options which are kind of not true in the story, right? You know, he's not got baby feet. Okay, but you know, maybe there's a range of normal shoe sizes for people roughly of his height, such that it's just not true in the story he's got size 10 feet, but it's not false in the story that he's got size 10 feet, okay? It's just left unsettled, okay? To begin, I just want to kind of note that whilst people often talk about incompleteness in this sense as though it's a uniform phenomenon, okay, a certain proposition, neither, you know, it's proposition P, such that neither P is true in the story nor not P is true in the story. So in that sense, it looks uniform in the way people characterize it. The phenomenon looks as though there are important differences between different kinds of cases. Okay, so let's start with the following example, which I guess is the kind of example people normally have in mind when they think about incompleteness in fiction. And that's the case of what we're going to call unspecified details. Okay, so you're reading American Psycho. You're not told what Patrick Bateman's first word was, okay? It's a kind of don't care issue, okay? It looks as though it's just an irrelevant thing that, in a sense, you want to feel like you can go either way on it, it doesn't really matter, okay? Contrast that case with, for instance, the question of whether in Blade Runner, Deckard is an android. Okay? The entire point of the story is the uncertainty about that. It feels very different from a don't care what his shoe size is case. Seems as though, you know, it's very, very important to understanding the story that you don't just go either way on it. You're left in a state of uncertainty when you engage with the story. And that looks as though it has a very different phenomenology from the kind of unspecified details case. So they're the cases we're mainly going to be thinking about, unspecified details and what we're calling deliberate withholding. But there are other cases in the vicinity that you might think count as versions of incompleteness that look as though they're slightly different. Okay. So a third kind of case you might think arises due to questions of genre classification. Okay. So for instance, ask the question, is The Turn of the Screw a ghost story? Okay. I don't care about the historical details. Let's just assume that there are two plausible ways of categorizing it which are consistent with all the relevant facts. And now ask the question, is it true in the story that there are ghosts? Well, if you read it one way, it is true in the story that there are ghosts. If you read it the other way, plausibly, it's false in the story that there are ghosts. So it looks as though, you know, you might think there's a certain kind of incompleteness with respect to the question of the existence of ghosts in the story, because the story can be read in two ways. Okay? And notice that that looks slightly different from the other cases we've been considering. Okay? The mechanism that generates the incompleteness looks as though it's something to do with the prior kind of assumptions or reading practices we have when we engage with the story, rather than when we've got the story, then there's a kind of openness that's there. A fourth kind of case, we're not going to talk about this very much, but you know, you might think there's a certain kind of incompleteness here, is what Kendall Walton calls silly questions. Okay? So consider the question of how Othello manages to speak in such fine verse off the cuff. Okay? You might think the story just doesn't give you an answer to that question. You know, plausibly, you know, it might just be a kind of convention of the way the story's written or whatever. But you might think there's a certain kind of incompleteness associated with those kind of cases. I'm not sure. I think different people will have different intuitions about that. So we'll kind of set those aside. And as I said, mainly we'll be focusing on unspecified details and deliberate withholding. So just notice that given that there looks to be important differences between these kinds of cases, it is kind of striking that the way that people typically talk about fictional incompleteness takes it to be a kind of uniform phenomenon when you regiment it, right? So claims of fictionality or claims of what's true in a story normally regimented using fictional operators of the form it's true in the story that P, and fictional incompleteness then emerges as neither P nor not P is fictional. That's a kind of uniform single thing, but now we, you know, how does that map on to the seeming variation that we're getting in these kinds of cases? Okay, so that's the kind of just initial puzzlement that we're going to try and resolve. Okay, so in order to kind of make progress on these issues, what we're going to do is think about the role that imagination plays with respect to fictionality. Okay, and it's kind of obvious that there's some important connection between imagination and fictionality. Okay. So Ken Walton in Mimesis and Make-Believe says that there is a connection between imagination and fiction is so obvious that it's like pulling a rabbit out of a hutch. Okay. It's just totally obvious that there's that kind of link. And here's one way to make that a little bit more interesting. It seems like, or a very plausible thought is that our imaginative engagement with fictions seems to be structured around what we take to be the correct imaginative response to what's true in the story. Okay? And we can think of this as like the cognitive role of fictionality. Okay? So there are other kinds of cases where we think about the cognitive role of certain kinds of phenomena. And indeed, Walton makes this link by drawing an analogy between the cognitive role of fictionality and the cognitive role of truth. Okay? So here's the quote from Mimesis and Make-Believe that is arguably the guiding analogy of Walton's entire project, or this one of the starting points. And Walton says, belief aims at truth. What is true and only what is true is to be believed. We're not free to believe as we please. And he says, imaginings are constrained also. Some are proper, appropriate in certain contexts, and others not. So the idea is that with respect to cognitive role, imagination stands to the fictional as belief stands to truth. Okay? So think of it like this. You know, when P is true, there's a certain objective sense in which subjects are obliged to believe that P. Okay? It's highly objectified, right? I mean, it might be that you don't have the right evidence, whatever, but in some objective sense, if P is true, then you ought to believe that P. Okay? And that kind of idea transposed to the case of fictionality gives us a kind of grip on some, at least part of the cognitive role of fictionality. So if a subject learns that P is true in a certain story, then it seems as though there's a sense in which that's the thing that they ought to imagine when engaging with the story. Now, somebody's coming in. So we can write the rule as something like this. So this is one of the bullet points on the bottom part of the handout. If P is fictional, that is, if it's true according to the story or the contextually relevant story, then imagine that P, okay? You could write it slightly differently, but I've put it in the imperative mood. Now, just to be clear, the kind of obligation that you have needs to be handled quite carefully, right? I mean, clearly it's only something that's relevant when you're engaging with the story, okay? In different stories, different things are going to be fictional, and so the things you ought to imagine in one context might be different from the things you ought to imagine in another context. Moreover, you might think there's a certain sense in which the kind of obligation is purpose relative. Okay? It looks as though, P's the thing to imagine if you're trying to appreciate the story, if that's your goal. But if you're just trying to pass the time, you can, imagine what you want, you might think. Okay? So the kind of obligation looks as though it needs to be handled carefully, but I take it we've got a kind of grip on what we're talking about that. Notice that you also get the rule that just applies in the case of things like negations that are fictionally true. So if not P is fictional, then not P is the thing to be imagined when you engage with the story, if your aim is to appreciate the story. Okay. And those things look as though they're analogous to the case of belief. If P is true, believe that P. If not P is true, believe that not P. Okay. So notice that the kind of the way that we're thinking about the norms that connect imagination and fictionality at the moment only tell us what to imagine in cases where there's a proposition that is fictionally true. Okay, but you remember from the start of the point, it's very familiar that there are lots of propositions that are neither fictionally true nor fictionally false. So consider a case where there's some proposition, maybe Holmes's shoe size is 10, okay, and its negation is not the case that Holmes's shoe size is 10. Okay, given that the story is kind of just incomplete with respect to that proposition, what are we supposed to do imaginatively speaking? Okay. The rule doesn't tell us yet because it only tells us what to do in the case where we have a proposition that is fictionally true, and it doesn't cover the case where there's a kind of gappiness or a case where the proposition isn't fictionally true. So we get a question, given we've got this partial grip on the connection between fictionality and the imagination, how do we extend the account to cover cases of incompleteness? Okay. So it's helpful here to distinguish two kinds of extremes, okay? So the first view is what we're going to call permissivism, okay? Permissivism says when you've got a proposition that's neither true in the story nor false in the story, you can imagine whatever you want, okay? You're permitted to go either way. And the second kind of view is what we'll call prohibitionism. Prohibitionism says if you learn that P is neither fictionally true nor fictionally false, you're prohibited from going either way, okay? You have no imaginative attitude at that point with respect to P, okay? And one way to see the difference is, just think of the rule that if P is not fictionally true, then don't imagine P, okay? The thing to do is not to imagine P. Okay? The prohibitionist says that's the appropriate rule. Okay? If you're in a kind of case of fictional incompleteness, don't imagine either of the options. Whereas the permissivist rejects that rule because they think that in a case of fictional incompleteness, you're permitted to go either way. Okay? And they're kind of extreme, two extreme views. Given the kind of variety of the cases that we've kind of began the talk by distinguishing, you might think it just looks that the permissive option is appropriate in some cases and the prohibition option is appropriate in other cases. Okay? So, for instance, think about what Patrick Bateman's first word was or what Holmes' shoe size was. Given that it's a don't care issue that doesn't seem to matter at all to the appreciation of the work, then you might think you can go either way on it. You're permitted to imagine that he's got size 10 feet. You're permitted to imagine he's got size 11 feet. Doesn't matter, go either way. In other cases, perhaps, for instance, the case of deliberate withholding, so the question of whether Descartes is an android, you might think that, given that the entire point of the story is to leave you in a state of uncertainty, it's not okay to just go either way, depending on your whims. Okay? The entire point is not to go either way and to be in a case of like uncertainty with respect to it. And that looks as though it might suggest that in those kinds of cases, the prohibitionist option is the appropriate one. Okay? Similarly, you might think in the case of genre classification, well, you can read the story either way. Nothing prevents you from going one way or the other. So you can just make your mind up. So that looks as though it's a case of permissivist kind of option. In the case of silly questions, you might think maybe that's another case in which the kind of prohibition option is better. Maybe. Okay, but at least it looks like in some cases of fictional incompleteness, the permissive norm looks correct. Okay, and in other cases, the prohibition norm looks as though it's correct. Okay, that's I think an intuitive thing to think. Now we're turning over. Okay, so notice that we've kind of run all of the discussion so far without having any really specific views in mind, okay? Just general observations about fictionality and imagination, kind of normative connection between the two. I think a nice next move to note, next thing to note is that if we consider like a very prominent view of fictionality due to Kendall Walton, Walton's view nicely accommodates a kind of pluralistic view. The pluralistic view being the permissive option is appropriate in some case and the kind of prohibition option is appropriate in other cases. And so I'll explain why Walton's account nicely accommodates this kind of pluralism. Okay. So Walton's approach to giving an account of fictionality or what's kind of true in a fiction is kind of interesting insofar as he tries to use what we've been calling the cognitive role of fictionality in order to give an account of the nature of fictionality. Okay? And the core of his account can be kind of characterized as what we've got on the handout as Walton's equation. Okay? So Walton says, what it is for a proposition to be fictional just is for there to be a prescription to imagine that proposition. Okay? So if your goal is to understand and appreciate the work, then the propositions that are true in the work will just line up with the things that you have to imagine in order to appreciate the work. Okay. And given that fictional incompleteness is a case in which a proposition's neither true in the story nor its negation's true in the story, that emerges as the following case, where there's no prescription to imagine P and there's no prescription to imagine not P. Okay. But what's interesting is, within Walton's account, the kind of incompleteness thought of in that kind of way, where there's no prescription to go one way and no prescription to go the other way, is also kind of consistent with two different extra claims. Okay? So in that sense, incompleteness can manifest itself in two very different ways in Walton's account. So the first way it might manifest it is, well, there's no prescription to imagine P, and there's no prescription to imagine not P. But There is a prescription not to imagine P, and there's a prescription not to imagine not P. Okay? The second kind of case is where the negations go in slightly, combine differently. So in the second case, there's no prescription to imagine P and no prescription to imagine not P. But there's no prescription not to imagine P and no prescription not to imagine not P. Okay? There's a lot of negations there, right? But think of it like this. In the first kind of case, what we've got is a case where there's a prohibition on imagining. Okay? Because in the first kind of case, there's a prescription not to imagine P, and there's a prescription not to imagine not P. Okay? So if we're in that kind of case, the prohibition norm just falls out immediately. If we're in the second kind of case, where there's no prescription to not to imagine P and no prescription not to imagine not P, then the permissive norm falls out naturally, because permission is the jewel of obligation. Okay? So in that sense, even though there's a kind of single way to think about fictional incompleteness within Walton's account, just there's no prescription to imagine P, no prescription to imagine not P, it can manifest itself in two very different ways. In one case, we get a kind of prohibition norm, don't go either way. And in the other case, we get a kind of permissive norm, you're permitted to go either way. Okay? And as far as I know, nobody has noted this aspect of Walton's account. For those of you who know Walton's account, I'll just say something. If you don't care about the details, then you can think about something else for a moment. So here's one way to think of it. So Walton's picture of how to think about fiction, as well as the way that I've been expressing it, can also be expressed in a way where we talk about the games of make-believe that are authorized by a given work. Okay? And here are two very different ways that you might end up with an incomplete work. Okay. So in the first kind of case, there are two different authorized games. In one authorized game, P is true. Okay. So in one authorized game, Holmes has size 10 feet. And in another authorized game, he has size 11 feet. And let's suppose they're the only two options, right?
Where do these restrictions and permissions come from?
Sorry?
You keep on talking about restrictions and permissions. Where do they come from? Is it from Kendall's account?
Yeah, exactly. Okay. So, in one kind of case, one of the authorized games is such that Holmes has size 10 feet. In the other case, there's an authorized game where he has size 11 feet. We ask what's true in the work, what's true in the fiction, and we ask what's true in all of the games. Okay. And given that in one of the games it's 10 and in the other game it's 11, there's a kind of incompleteness with respect to his shoe size that falls out. Okay. Here's a different way it might go. There's no authorized game where he has size 10 feet. There's no authorized game where he has size 11 feet. But in every authorized game, it's one or the other. Okay. So the only authorized games are themselves gappy. Okay? It's not true in the game that he's got size 10, and it's not true in the game that he's got size 11, but it is true that he's got one or the other. Okay? In both cases, we're going to get an incomplete work. Okay? For instance, it won't be true in every authorized game that he's got size 10 feet. But the mechanism that generates that is very different. Okay? So here's one way to think of it. In the case of a prohibition, the games themselves are gappy. Whereas in the case of a permissive option, the games can be more complete than the work. It's just that they make different decisions on how to fill in the gaps. Okay. Okay. So, taking a step back, Walton's account predicts a kind of pluralism. At least it's possible. Okay. Just his account naturally suggests that there should be cases where we get a kind of prohibition norm. That's the case in which we are prescribed not to imagine either way. And that there are cases where we get the kind of permissive norm. That's the case where you're not prescribes not to go either way. Okay. Good. So, here's one way to see why you might find some of this puzzling. So think about the guiding analogy. The guiding analogy was that fictionality is related to the imagination, as truth is related to belief. Okay? And now we're considering cases of gaps in what's fictional. So that should be analogous to gaps in what's true. And indeed, you know, plausibly there are lots of cases of this, right? Think of, for instance, like presupposition failures. The King of France is bald. Well, given that there's no King of France, you know, it's neither true nor false. Or if you have certain views about the open future, maybe you think there's just no fact of the matter, it's not true that there'll be a sea battle tomorrow, it's not false that there'll be a sea battle tomorrow, right? It's just unsettled. But when we're dealing with truth value gaps, nobody thinks that the permissive option is okay with respect to belief, okay? If you're in a case where there's a truth value gap, you're not allowed to believe what you want, right? If it's neither true nor false that there'll be a sea battle tomorrow, you're not allowed to believe that there will, okay? If we're in a case of presupposition failure, and it's neither true nor false that the King of France is bald, you're not allowed to believe that he is bald. Okay. In those cases, there's a prohibition in all the cases on what you're allowed to believe. So that at least suggests that if we're really going to build the approach to fictionality by thinking about a connection, an analogy with belief, something's gone a little bit odd here. Okay. So that's one observation. A second observation is when we've got cases where there's a gap in what's true in the story, it doesn't feel like the case, you know, phenomenologically, it doesn't feel like a case of something like presupposition failure. Okay? It's much more akin to something like a gap in your evidence. Okay? So in lots of cases, our evidence doesn't warrant believing one way or the other. Okay? And we're not allowed to go just either way, randomly just believe the P, even though my evidence, you know, doesn't suggest it. Like, it looks as though you know, cases of incomplete fiction in that sense look more akin to cases of ignorance, evidential gaps, than they look as though they're analogous to presupposition failure or truth value gaps. Okay, so there's something about the analogy which looks as though it's problematical, and there's something about the phenomenology which looks as though it might not suggest the kind of permissive option is appropriate. Now, you might at this point, and I think that this is what Walton would do, is say, look, it's just an analogy, right? I'm not saying it's kind of appropriate and, you know, totally analogous in all respects. But I think it's kind of interesting project of, can you work out an account where the analogy is much more close than you might think, or, you know, Walton might think it is. And the account that we're going to suggest of what's going on in the case of incomplete fictions allows you to maintain that they're much more similar to, there's a much closer analogy between belief and imagination and fictionality and truth than you might suspect that there is. Okay, so as far as I know, and I don't know this literature inside out, but the vast majority of discussions of the imagination assume that imagining is either on or off. It's categorical. Okay? It's the imaginative analog of what's sometimes called the full belief model of belief, where you think that belief is either on or off. The full belief model of belief is widely rejected. Okay? The vast majority of people who work on belief think belief is something that admits of degrees. Okay? People talk about credences, being more or less confident, having a certain kind of, you know, an attitude towards a proposition that's neither, you know, one nor zero. It can be somewhere in between, kind of half belief. You're 0.5, okay? And, you know, it's kind of interesting that nobody's explored, as far as I know, the view that imagining might have a similar kind of degreed structure, okay? And the account that we're going to propose will indeed kind of have that feature Okay, imaginings can be kind of more or less. Okay, so to think about, this is over on page 3. Think about like beliefs being partial. Okay, so here's an example to try and motivate the idea. Take the proposition that FIFA will be corrupt in the year 2020. Okay, I'm pretty confident that that's going to be true. Okay, I have no real hope that they're going to sort all the problems out in the next 4 or 5 years. I'm not totally confident. I'm not certain. Okay. I don't think it's like totally hopeless, right? I think there's a chance, a slight chance they'll sort it out. Okay. So I'm more confident that they're going to be corrupt than not corrupt, but I'm not fully certain. Okay. I'm not fully confident. Okay. And you might think that with respect to my kind of beliefs, it's not that I have a kind of on or off thing. I've just got an attitude towards that proposition that's maybe 0.8. Okay. I'm confident to 0.8 that they're going to be corrupt, and confident to 0.2 that they're going to not be corrupt. Okay. Similarly, if you think about imagination, you might think, right, so here's an example to push the intuition that there's a similar kind of structure in the case of imagination. So take the proposition that Bateman's first word was mama. Okay. Imaginatively speaking, you might think that's pretty similar to the case of belief. I'm imaginatively quite confident that that's true. Babies tend to say that as their first word. Okay. Some babies don't. Some babies might say dada or America or something else, right? So my attitude, my imaginative attitude to that proposition doesn't look as though it's something that's either on or off. You might think that just as in the case of belief, it's something that admits a degree. Okay. I'm imaginatively very confident that it's mama, but I'm not fully confident, imaginatively speaking. Okay, it's again something that's got a kind of degreed structure. Okay. So, in the case of belief, people talk about credence. Okay, full belief is credence 1. You know, total non-belief is credence 0. Most beliefs get something in between 1 and 0. We're going to call the corresponding thing in the case of imaginings imaginative credence, okay? But don't think of that as imagining having a credence, okay? It's where you think the credence thing is built into the imagining rather than built into the content of the imagining, okay? Okay, so that's an idea, okay? There's a similar kind of structural analogy between belief and imagination with respect to the kind of degreed structure that they exhibit. Okay. Now remember the original question that we were asking about the normative role of incomplete fictions. The question was, if neither P nor not P is fictionally true, what's the correct imaginative attitude to have? One view, prohibitionism, said both imaginings are incorrect. Okay, don't go either way. The permissive option said, neither imagining is incorrect. You're allowed to go either way. But if you think that there's a kind of graded nature of cognitive states in general, if you think that there's a kind of imaginative analog to credence, then there's another view which looks as though it's what, you know, precisely corresponds to what a lot of people, Bayesians, think in the case of belief. So the evidentialist option that we're going to talk about says this. If neither P nor not P is fictional, then you're supposed to have a certain imaginative credence in P. You take your fictive evidence, and then you conditionalize on that evidence and come up with a certain probability for P. Okay? So for instance, maybe the propositions that are fictionally true all get probability 1. The propositions that are fictionally false get probability 0, and other things are going to get something in between as determined by this kind of rule. Okay. That would predict an analogy between these cases and the case of belief. Okay. So normally you think like, you know, what your credence, like beliefs in like belief credences in a proposition should be is the conditional probability of that proposition given your evidence. Okay? And this is just the fictive analog of that. Your imaginative credence in P should be the conditional probability of P given the fictive evidence. Okay. So one question is, what's the evidence? Okay. What counts as evidence in this kind of picture? Just as in the case of the kind of Bayesian literature in epistemology, there's a bunch of different options. One option would be the evidence is whatever is fictionally true. Okay. Another view would say your evidence is what you know to be fictionally true. Okay. There'll be other kinds of views in the vicinity as well. So, you know, we could go through those things, like interesting options, and we can talk about them if you'd like. But we're just going to assume for the sake of argument, the evidence is what's true in the story, and then you conditionalize on that. Okay. One thing to note about this is that evidentialism is a kind of prohibitionism. Okay. When neither P nor not P is fictionally true, you should never be imaginatively certain in either. Okay. If we're in a kind of case of incomplete fictions, you're not allowed to fully imagine P. You're supposed to have a certain specific credence as determined by the formula, but it's not going to be one. So in that sense, the evidentialist option looks as though it's closer with the kind of prohibitionism than permissivism. That said, there is a subtlety, which is the evidentialist option is consistent with a kind of permissivism. Okay, and here's one way to think of that. In the case of credence, it looks as though, or here's one worry, the Bayesian, or the person who's an evidentialist about belief, is saying that rationality requires a given agent to have a very specific credence in any proposition. Okay? And you might worry, well, how could that be? How can it be the case that, for instance, both Stacy and I are required to have exactly the same credence in a certain proposition? Okay. And some people in that literature say, yeah, look, there's a kind of permissivism that we have about what we count as something like the prior beliefs that get fed in before you do the calculation. Okay, so there's a kind of permissivism maybe that's consistent with it, but it's very different from what we've been considering. Before we were considering an option where people could just imagine what they want. In this case, it's slightly different, but yeah, I'm sorry if that was a little bit vague, but hopefully the picture should hopefully be clear enough. Okay, we've got a kind of graded notion of imagination, and the particular kind of imaginative credence you have is determined by this evidentialist formula. And that would give a nice analogy between the way in which things work with respect to fiction and imagination as people think work with respect to truth and belief in the kind of Bayesian literature. Okay. So we like this view. Okay. We think this view looks very sensible. Okay. But if you're tempted to accept it, like we are, it looks as though you've got some explaining to do, right? Because the permissive option looked really, really natural, okay? It looked as though in don't care issues, like what his shoe size is, you just are allowed to go either way. It looks as though it'd be really weird to think you're supposed to be 0.3 on that proposition, or 0.3333 or whatever, right? Surely you're allowed to go either way. Now, we think that there's a kind of sense in which that intuition that you're allowed to go either way is right, but also consistent with the view that we're suggesting. So here's the idea. The intuition that you can imagine what you please in some cases of fictional incompleteness is ambiguous. Okay? There's a difference between saying that you're allowed to imagine whatever you want in response to a story and saying that you're allowed to suppose whatever you want in relation to a story, okay? And this is familiar in the case of belief. So, for instance, it would be wrong, given my evidence, for me to believe that Arsenal will win the league next year, unfortunately. But there's no problem with me supposing that Arsenal will win the league next year, okay? So I'm not allowed to fully believe it, but I'm allowed to suppose whatever I want. And maybe once I've supposed that, I will come to believe some other things, like if Arsenal will win the league next year, then they'll buy a world-class centre-forward in the next transfer window. Okay. So even though there's a kind of prohibition on belief, like full belief in these kind of cases, we're allowed to suppose whatever we want. Okay. And given the similarities between belief and imagination, it'd be surprising if we didn't get similar kinds of reasoning replicated in the case of fiction. And you might think it just is. So suppose that you're watching Twin Peaks. I'm sorry if you want to watch this and I'm going to give it all away, but anyway, you can't do this. Like, you have to use examples that will upset people, so I'm sorry. Okay. So you're watching Twin Peaks, you're at a certain stage of the story. Okay. Given the fictive evidence which is available to you at the end of season one, it would be wrong for you to imagine that Leland killed Laura. Okay. But there's no problem with supposing that he did. Okay. And maybe once you suppose within the scope of your imaginative project that he killed Laura, that you'll come to imagine, for instance, that if he did it, then he must have drugged his wife. Okay. So the idea is there's an imaginative project, and within the scope of that imaginative project, you can suppose certain things. And we're allowed to suppose whatever we want. That's familiar from the case of belief. Okay. So the intuition that you're allowed to go whichever way you want in response to the story looks as though you could account for it by saying that you're allowed to suppose whatever you want, even though you're not allowed to imagine whatever you want. And it would be no surprise that people would confuse that. Imagination and supposition look as though they're very closely connected. Okay. Importantly different, but closely connected. Okay, so we're on the last page. How long have I been talking for? Good, doing well. Okay. So that's the idea. We can think of our apparently permissive responses to some cases of fictional incompleteness along these lines. We're merely supposing, for instance, that Watson has blue eyes rather than imagining that he has blue eyes. Okay. And we don't think this is ad hoc, okay? So just think about the case of non-fiction. So I'm worried about this because I think Stacey will probably tell me that this is wrong, but we'll hope for the best. So it seems like when people... So in the case of reading fiction, we often fill in unspecified details. We imagine the characters to have certain eye colours and whatever, even though nothing in the story tells us one way or the other. We do that in the case of non-fiction too. If you read a newspaper report and you're kind of whatever, thinking about what's going on, you may well, within that, fill in the blanks. Okay, maybe the characters, you know, the people in the story come to have a certain eye color or whatever. But nobody thinks in that case that you're really believing that the people you're reading about have blue eyes. Okay, you're supposing, you might think. Okay, so what's going on in the case of nonfiction? You fill in the details, but it's more like a supposition than a belief. Looks as though it might be replicated in the case of fiction, insofar as you're filling in the details, but in a sense it's an imaginative supposition rather than something that you're fully imagining. Okay. So that's one thought. Here's a second thought. The functional role, in a certain sense, of imaginings seem more like suppositions in the case of for instance, Watson's eye colour. Okay. So, if you're really imagining, rather than just supposing, that Watson has blue eyes, then you should have certain dispositions. For instance, maybe you should be disposed to fear for Watson if it turns out that all the blue-eyed people in the story are going to be killed. But I don't seem to be so disposed, even if I'm imagining, you know, even if I'm engaging with the story and filling in the detail. Okay, if I learnt that all blue-eyed people were going to be killed, but I was kind of engaging with the story and thinking that he had blue eyes, it looks as though I just, you know, that doesn't seem as though it kind of interacts in the same way you would get if it was a genuine imagining. So it seems like not only do you get analogous phenomena in the case of non-fiction, but the functional role of these kinds of cases seem more like suppositions than rather full-blown imaginings. Okay. Good. Okay. So that's the kind of picture. There's a kind of evidentialist view at the heart of what you're supposed to imagine when you're in the case of fictional incompleteness. But we do think that there's an exception, or at least a potential exception, to this kind of rule. Okay? So we think this is like the heart of what's going on in most cases of fictional incompleteness. But there's an exception. Sometimes the rule gets overridden. Okay? And to think of the cases where this might happen, there's a third kind of way in which you might be prescribed to imagine something that, again, as far as I know, nobody's talked about. So this is what we're going to call prescribed P imagining. Okay. So in this case, there's a prescription to imagine P or imagine not P. Okay. A prescription to have one imagining or another imagining. Okay. And notice that's consistent with then being neither a prescription to imagine P nor a prescription to imagine not P. It's as simple as it saying you have to go either way, but you're not forced to go either way. Okay? Notice that if we've got a case of prescribed P imagining, it's inconsistent with there being a prohibition on going either way. That would be very weird. That would be a case in which you're told you have to go one way or the other, and you're not allowed to go either way. Okay, that looks as though it's very confusing. Okay, so it seems like, if it's inconsistent with prohibition, that it entails a certain kind of permissivism. If the rule, if the kind of norm is saying you have to go one way or the other, then it seems like you have to be allowed to go one way or the other. So now we get a question. Even if prohibition via the kind of evidentialist view is the kind of normal rule governing the imaginative responses to cases of incompleteness, it might be overridden in cases where we've got prescribed P imagining. Because in the case of prescribed P imagining, we get permissivism falling out. And now the question is, are there any cases of fictional incompleteness where it might plausibly be held that there is a prescription to engage in P imagining? Okay? Even though the story is incomplete with respect to that proposition. Okay. Now, it certainly seems implausible in the case of unspecified details. Okay? Even if you think it's permissible to go either way on Holmes's shoe size, you don't think that somehow you're required to go one way or the other, okay? If you don't imagine one way or the other, that's fine, okay? So it looks as though there's not a kind of prescription to go one way or the other. You have to imagine it's size 10 or size 11, okay? Quite strange. So it looks as though that case doesn't work. And the case of withholding details look as though they naturally go with the kind of prohibition option. And we know that the prescribed P imagining is inconsistent with prohibition, so that case is out too. However, if you think about incompleteness that might arise through genre classification, you might think that this is a case where there's a prescription to engage in P imagining, even though there's no requirement to go one way or the other. Okay. So again, take the turn of the screw, and let's just suppose that there's a kind of choice about how you read it. Could be a ghost story, might not be a ghost story, okay? You might think that what's going on there is the work's telling you, or the work in a certain context is telling you, look, either read it as a ghost story or read it as something else. And you're allowed to go either way. Once you go one way, it turns out that it's true in the story, true in the story that there are ghosts. Going the other way, it's false in the story that there are ghosts. And at least plausibly, you have to go one way or the other. You can't read a work outside of any genre. Okay? So in that sense, you have to either read it one way or the other. And that looks as though it's at least plausibly a case in which it entails a certain kind of P imagining, right? There'll be a prescription to either imagine that there are ghosts or imagine that there are no ghosts. And that'll just fall out of reading it one way or reading it the other way. Okay. So think of it like this. You might get a free choice with respect to the genre classification question. And you have to read it one way or the other. And that kind of overrides the normal kind of evidentialist role. Once you fix the genre, everything runs as before. Okay? But there might be a certain exception to the kind of evidentialist story in these kinds of cases. Okay? Okay, so that's the case of genre classification. There are other cases where you might think you get similar kinds of phenomena. Okay, so for instance, take, you know, these kind of make your own story, make your own adventure. Okay, the only way of proceeding with the kind of work and engaging with the work requires you to make choices. Okay, and it looks as though there's a prescription to go one way or the other, even though there's no prescription to go either way. So that's another kind of case where it looks as though there's a prescribed peer imagining. You're forced to make a choice, and both choices are available to you, even though there's no requirement to go one way or the other. Okay, so that's a second kind of case where it looks as though there might be a kind of prescription to go one way or the other, a prescription to engage in a kind of peer imagining, even though the story is incomplete. And that would override the normal kind of story because there's a kind of permissivism that's involved. Okay, good. So let's take stock. Let's try and think about the take-home message, okay? So one thing is the way that people normally think about fiction involves thinking about fictionality as involving kind of fictional operators, what's true in the story, what's false in the story, okay? And that gives a certain kind of unified characterization of fictional incompleteness that looks as though it's in tension with the variety of cases that actually get manifested there. In Walton's kind of picture, you can explain what's going on, why there's multiple different kinds of cases. Some cases will be permissive, other cases will be permissive. But what we've suggested is that if you want to maintain a kind of link between imagination and fictionality that's analogous to the link between belief and truth, then what you should think is something like there's an evidentialist norm that's telling you what imaginative credence you should have in a proposition in a case of fictional incompleteness. There might be a certain exception to that, but the cases look quite specific and a very different kind of permissivism is suggested than, you know, what we got before. So in that sense, the account is, you know, pluralistic, but at its heart, there's a kind of evidentialism that's present there that gets overridden in certain special cases. Okay. So I'll stop there, and thank you for listening.